Could I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
This is KPTC 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. This is Attention Please, and I'm your host this week, Jim Burke, and I'm here with Peter Lumsdaine. Peter, good morning.
Good morning.
Peter, tell me about yourself and why you're here.
Well, I live here in Jefferson County with my wife and two kids who are both in high school now, and I am connected to an organization called Physicians for Social Responsibility, or PSR. I'm not an MD myself, but the organization is made up of health professionals and others working with a very strong focus on the need for nuclear weapons abolition, also doing some work on climate and economic justice as well. But I am on the Nuclear Weapons Abolition Task Force of National PSR and also the Washington State branch. So that's one reason I'm here.
Wow, that's incredible. When we talked on the phone and also when we spoke on email, you were talking about the correlation between the Cuban Missile Crisis, which happened 60 years ago.
That's right.
In fact, it started to happen 60 years ago this week as we record this, and we're recording this on October 20th. And it will air, I believe, the day before Election Day, November 7th. So tell me about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just give us some background on that and why that was a watershed moment in terms of nuclear posturing and proliferation.
Right. Well, I think most people have heard about that very critical occurrence historically in the early 1960s. And I think that also there has been some, probably not enough, but some articles appearing in the press recently, because as you say, it is the 60th anniversary of that 13-day crisis, which went from October 16th to October 29th. So we're right in the midst of that. And I look at this entire autumn here as sort of the anniversary season. So the fact that we're airing in November is really not that significantly different. This autumn, you know, is 60 years after what most people believe is the closest we've ever come to nuclear world war. And it was an extremely dangerous and fraught moment. And I think one of the things that I really want to emphasize in this is, number one, we are moving in the same direction very rapidly, again, with the confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, potentially the U.S. and China in the near future, and many of the same dynamics are at work. And the other thing I really want to emphasize about that is that it was through the ability of two very, very flawed and imperfect leaders, John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, to realize the stakes and to reach a compromise that averted a catastrophe. It's also interesting to note that the third person who was really critical in preventing this from turning into a global nuclear war was a Soviet submarine officer who had been out of touch with Moscow, and two of his colleagues on the submarine were ready to fire a nuclear-tipped torpedo at the U.S. Navy warships, which were surrounding the submarine, dropping depth charges to try and force it to the surface. And two of the three officers wanted to fire this torpedo because they believed the war had already started. They were out of touch with Moscow, and they thought, this is it. And this one guy, I'll mention his name later on, but this one guy said, no, no, we cannot do this until we find out what's really going on. So they did not fire the torpedo. They did surface. And that particular, which was very late in the crisis, it was towards the end of October, averted a cataclysm that would have escalated out of control from there. So those are lessons, I think, that are really important.
And was that submarine in the midst of that? They didn't call it a blockade, because I understand that calling it a blockade would have been considered an act of war. So they called it a quarantine.
Quarantine, that's correct.
Where they basically kept a Soviet weaponry and Soviet personnel from coming into Cuba after they realized that they were building medium-range and short-range
ballistic
missile
nuclear capable,
there,
right.
Nuclear
yeah,
capability.
That's right. But, you know, one of the things which many people don't know, and in fact it wasn't public at the time, was that there were three basic elements to the agreement that was struck between Kennedy and Khrushchev. Part of this was public, and part of it was not public until later. One key part was that Khrushchev did agree to withdraw those missiles from Cuba. Kennedy made a presidential pledge that the United States military would not invade Cuba, which the Joint Chiefs of Staff was recommending to the president at that time. But he made a pledge that we would not invade Cuba. And the other thing was that we would withdraw our nuclear Jupiter missiles from Turkey, which were very close to the border of the USSR. That had been contemplated to occur later anyway, but they made a commitment to go ahead and remove those missiles. Although
they did that very quietly.
They did it very quietly. But so these were the key elements of a strategic compromise that Khrushchev and Kennedy reached, I think motivated by the understanding that this would be a cataclysm for both countries and for the people of the planet.
Right. Going into that, it sounded like Khrushchev and the USSR had a much smaller arsenal of nuclear weapons at that point, and we had a much larger one.
Absolutely.
And that part of the rationale for putting the missiles in Cuba, part of it was the fact that they were sort of behind, and that they were, it would take them to 65 or 66 to actually catch up in terms of the nuclear weapons and in terms of the long-range missiles.
Right.
But also, they wanted West Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted a lever to get West Berlin out of the hands of NATO and mm-hmm. Europe. But they didn't succeed in that.
No, I mean, I think the whole Berlin dimension of it is somewhat more debatable, in my opinion. But certainly they were very concerned about the lack of nuclear parity with the United States and the presence of U.S. nuclear missiles on their borders, for instance, in Turkey. And you're right, the U.S. had a much, much greater capacity at the time. Years ago, when I was a young activist, I met a guy who was very high up in the U.S. military command structure. And there is something which existed at that time, and it still exists, called SIOP, S-I-O-P, that Strategic Integrated Operational Plan. And it's basically the operational scenario for nuclear war. This guy actually wrote the first one.
Oh, nice.
And he was involved in that in the early 60s, although he later became an ardent advocate of nuclear disarmament. Some people might recognize the name. That was Daniel Ellsberg. Who is better known perhaps for the Pentagon Papers about Vietnam, but he was also very high up in the nuclear command system. And in fact, 5 years ago, just recommend this to people if they're not aware of it, Ellsberg published a book after many years of work called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which is in the public library here. So Ellsberg was very critical in informing many people, including me, you know, when I was just in college, out of college, of what was really behind U.S. nuclear strategy and the kind of moves that had been made. You know, one of the things that I think is really important to recognize, that it's very possible, as I think most people feel, to be deeply dismayed at what is happening in Ukraine and what the Russian military is doing in Ukraine, and yet also to see, and this is not so widely done, that there is an enormous double standard which is being used for propaganda purposes to escalate the rhetoric and escalate, I believe, the conflict in a very, very dangerous way. So for instance, finally, after 8 months, the Russian military has started to systematically target the electrical infrastructure of Ukraine.
Right.
And
just this week,
I know people in town, teachers and other people in the press said, you know, this is outrageous, this is a war crime, and so forth and so on. And yet you remember, for instance, when Colin Powell passed away, there was a big state funeral. When people refer to George Bush Sr., it's usually as a kind of a measured elder statesman and so forth. But if you look back to 1991, this is precisely what the United States did in Desert Storm. It's all documented. It wasn't just a matter of fighting the Iraqi army in the deserts around Kuwait. In that bombing campaign, we took out 96% of the Iraqi electric grid capacity. And it was public, it was systematic. That doesn't make either action right, but it does mean that governments use accusations for propaganda purposes in an escalatory way, which on closer examination really is the exact same thing that they themselves have been doing. So I think what we need to say as people of the United States, people of planet Earth, is that it's not acceptable for governments to take actions which put at vast risk civilian populations, and that both leading powers have done this. And we still have a nuclear first use policy. They've tried for years and years to get the United States to adopt a no first use policy. This is one of the key points of what we call Back from the Brink. It's a PSR-related national campaign to take several de-escalatory nuclear policy steps. And yet, the United States continues to reserve this option. And in fact, one of the things that Ellsberg documents in this book, just to add this one other point, is that the United States not only has refused to adopt a no first use of nuclear weapons policy, but in fact, the U.S. has both secretly and publicly threatened first use of nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states again and again and again throughout its history. So again, this idea that, you know, it's only this terrible guy in the Kremlin, Putin, you know, who would consider such a thing, is simply not historically accurate. It's something that big nuclear powers, and particularly the United States, have done. And of course, it's got to stop on both sides.
Well, what's interesting also, this is how publicly Nikita Khrushchev said a lot of really horrible things publicly, very threatening things against the United States. But then privately, when he began to realize the stakes and when he began to realize that we might destroy Cuba or take it over, or that we might actually retaliate if they were to send a nuclear weapon, John Kennedy basically said in his speech to the country about this crisis that if they fired a missile against anybody in this Western Hemisphere, that there would be retaliatory consequences. But obviously, there's a lot of brinksmanship. Right now, there's a lot of brinksmanship between Putin and Biden, which is very disturbing to watch.
Right. It is.
But do you think that Putin, how do we know that he will be as sane as Khrushchev turned out to be when Khrushchev was faced with reality?
Or that Biden will be as sane as Kennedy? I mean, you know, there was an article recently in a strategic policy journal that specifically was calling on President Biden to re-examine the approach that JFK took during the Cuban Missile Crisis because it revolved around the idea of a negotiated compromise. Now, a lot of people say, oh, no, no, we can't compromise with, you know, Putin or Russia. But in fact, this is how war after war has been resolved and settled. And this is how the Cuban Missile Crisis was dealt with, that averted that catastrophic event that otherwise would have taken place. You know, Kennedy, about 7 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis and about 6 months before he was murdered in Dallas, Texas, gave a speech at American University. And it's a very, very significant one on the 10th of June in 1963. And I just want to just read this quote from Kennedy's speech. This is JFK at American University. And I think that this would be something which President Biden and the leaders of this country, as well as other nations that we are in competition with, would be very, very well advised to consider very carefully. But particularly when we're looking at Ukraine and Russia and the way that the thing is escalating right now and the forces that are moving into place, you know, there's two nuclear war preparedness exercises that are going on this fall in the second half of October. One of them is called Steadfast Noon. That is a NATO nuclear war practice exercise where they put the jets airborne that would carry tactical nuclear weapons, we still got them, not as many as Russia, but we still have them in Europe, to their targets. At the same time, the Russians are getting ready for their Grom or Thunder nuclear war preparedness. So you have these two countries which together control 90% of the thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons that still exist on the planet, both running these nuclear war preparedness exercises at the same time in the midst of this conflict in Central Europe. All right, so Kennedy said on June 10th, he said, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to the choice of either a humiliating retreat or nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish. So Kennedy was saying you cannot realistically corner an adversary in the nuclear age into the choice of escalation or humiliation. And this, again, this is how the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved, by reaching a negotiated compromise. I know a lot of people don't want to hear it, but with the stakes that are involved, it's really critical for people to understand that, like JFK said.
I'm going to just take a little break here and say this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Attention Please. I'm speaking with Peter Lumsdaine, who is with the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and his particular focus is on nuclear disarmament. So you mentioned John Kennedy in his speech in 63 during the Cuban Missile Crisis itself. He used the word peace a lot, that we are a peaceful nation. We don't want war. We will retaliate if attacked, but we don't want to start anything here. And yet there's a lot of evidence, as you've said, that we are prepared to start things if need be. I'm just curious about the numbers. So back then, it was like the Soviets had a few hundred warheads, and they had a few hundred missiles. Mm-hmm. And then we had maybe over 1,000 warheads and maybe 1,000 missiles. And I know that by the time they were doing the treaties in the 70s and 80s, the START and the START II and all that, we were talking about more warheads and more missiles
right.
that we were supposed to come back from. Mm-hmm. That after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a red phone, a hotline between Moscow. Right. And Washington, D.C.
Right.
Do you know if the phone is still there? Is the hotline still there, right, with Putin?
I'm sure there is a direct communications link between the White House and the Kremlin. I doubt if it's a red, you know, old-fashioned telephone sitting on a desk. But I'm sure that there's a direct communications link.
Right.
And I hope that both of those leaders are ready to use that to talk and to try to, again, de-escalate the situation. When you're talking about the numbers and arms control and so forth, one of the things that has happened since the 1980s, which is good, is that the numbers of U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear weapons on alert, ready to go, has very much decreased. That's the good news. The bad news is twofold. Number one, we still have thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. Of those, probably 1,500 to 1,700 strategic weapons on each side, ready to go on a moment's notice. This is another point in Back from the Brink, that they are advocating for a de-alerting, taking the weapons off of hair trigger alert, because we do have survivable forces, and there have been repeated electronic glitches and problems and false alarms that have occurred over the decades mm-hmm. that have brought us, again, much, much closer than we would want to a false alarm of a nuclear attack. There was a film back, it was a fictional film back in the 1980s called War Games, about these two teenagers who hacked into a you know, strategic computer.
Matthew Broderick and Elizabeth Shue.
There you go. But that is quite aside from the historical fact of these false alarms. In fact, I think in one case in 1979, it was a 46-cent computer chip that failed and triggered this thing. In another case, there was a training tape that was put into an operational slot, and so it looked like there were all these Russian missiles coming in.
Great.
So these kinds of things have occurred. So de-alerting, taking the weapons off of hair, survivable weapons that we have, taking them off of hair trigger alert, is another point in the Back from the Brink program. But, you know, the numbers have decreased, but we still have a huge number of thermonuclear weapons.
Do we still have mutual assured destruction?
Absolutely, no question. Right. And, you know, the latest studies that have come out about the impacts of a nuclear war, even a so-called limited nuclear war, if such a thing is plausible, on the global climate, on global agriculture, on global famine and starvation, are very, very sobering. People, billions of people, literally outside of the target zones, nuclear target zones, would be at risk of starving to death very rapidly because of crop failures, because of all the soot and air and so on. Now, the other thing, the other bad news, is that while the quantitative arms race has ramped down to a certain point, it's still huge arsenals on both sides.
Right.
And again, Russia and the United States have 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. The qualitative arms race has only continued and accelerated. And this is where the whole idea of extremely destabilizing idea of a first strike capability comes into play. As the missiles get faster and faster, more and more accurate, there is the perception, at least, on both sides, but particularly I would say on the Russian side, because our technology is much more advanced, that there would be a potential in a crisis for a disarming first strike that would take out their ability to retaliate. And that is what pushes, more than anything else, those weapons towards hair trigger alert.
Right.
So that's a very difficult and dangerous aspect of the thing. It's another reason that we need to take down the most destabilizing first strike capable weapon systems first, I believe. And obviously we need to work towards reduction and elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide. There's a treaty now, an international treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons, which dozens and dozens and dozens of countries have signed. But of course, the United States and Russia and China and India and Pakistan and North Korea and Israel have expressed no interest.
So anyone with a nuclear weapon or someone who wants one soon.
Right, right. So, you know, as difficult as it is, this is what these grassroots movements are about in the United States and other countries, to work towards a wake-up call, sanity, that we need to back away, well, as the phrase goes, away from the brink of a global cataclysm. And, you know, it's interesting because PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, has an international branch or partner, which is called International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War. And that was formed in the 1980s, 70s or 80s, Dr. Helen Caldicott really got PSR going in this country, but they formed the International Alliance of Russian or Soviet and American Physicians and Health Professionals, and they won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for their work, International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War. So these kinds of movements, which unfortunately are not nearly as strong now as they were in the 1980s, really need to be given support and energy and more people getting involved.
If anyone wanted to get involved or support these organizations, where would they start?
Well, I'm just going to give you a local contact here. We're in Port Townsend, Jefferson County, so I'm just going to put out an email address if anybody is interested in what's being said. And also, I'll just emphasize this, that if anybody in Jefferson County or beyond is interested in a talk, a workshop, a discussion group, a presentation, a briefing, whatever, I go out and do these a fair amount, and I'm more than happy to be in touch with them. But I would say the contact number for our area here, or contact email, I'll just say it and then spell it. It's in Spanish. Tierra Linda, which means beautiful earth in Spanish. TIERRALINDA at liveorlive.com. I'll just say that again. TIERRALINDA, Tierra Linda, at live.com. There are, of course, websites for Physicians for Social Responsibility, Back from the Brink, and so forth. But that's a local contact here, or if people are interested in Jefferson County or beyond, in getting, particularly with this Cuban Missile Crisis anniversary this autumn, and particularly with the current escalating crisis on the world stage, are interested in having a talk, a briefing, a discussion, a workshop, please feel free to contact us.
Just a quick question about that. So one of the things that I've noticed happens just occasionally is that North Korea likes to send missiles over Japan some from time to time, and then the U.S. forces in the Pacific like to do war maneuvers in league with South Korea, and they do these periodically. Is there a chicken and egg thing here? Is there, like, they know that the military exercises are coming up, so they send up some missiles, or they send up some missiles, and then the military exercises happen? Because it seems like they very often happen in the same month. But is there any correlation between the two of them?
Of course there is. I mean, if you look at history, not only in the 21st century and the 20th century, but going back for thousands of years, rival powers have always tried to show and threaten their military capabilities off against each other. You can really trace this back through history to the Roman Empire or before. And so much of this chess game that's going on with hundreds of millions of lives at stake is about who is going to be on top of the global resource and power structure of the 21st century. You know, China, Russia, the United States, and to some extent secondary powers are all maneuvering for position. And we the ordinary people of all countries, are the pawns in the game unless we organize and speak up. One thing that happened in the 1980s, which I think was very important, and it might have added to the pressure for at least some limits on the nuclear arms race, and is very absent at the moment from our movement and organizations, is that there was a huge direct action, civil disobedience, civil resistance component. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of people who were arrested at nuclear weapons facilities across the United States and in other countries in the 1980s. One of those places actually was Vandenberg Air Force Base. You talk about the missile test. Most people are still unaware that we are continually taking intercontinental ballistic missiles out of their silos, taking off the warhead, shipping them from Wyoming or North Dakota to Vandenberg, put in an identical silo, and test fired across the Pacific to Kwajalein Atoll, which is a U.S. military-occupied piece of Marshallese land. We know that the people of the Marshall Islands suffered enormously during the U.S. nuclear testing program there, and in fact are still suffering. There's a lot of Marshallese here in Washington State, actually. But Vandenberg is the launch point for Kwajalein Atoll, the largest coral atoll on the planet, which is still occupied by the U.S. military. There were thousands of people who were forcibly removed from Kwajalein Atoll, and there was resistance to that back in the 1980s. That's subsided, but in 1982, there was an action that the Marshallese took called Operation Homecoming, Darlene Kaju and some of the other leaders, to reoccupy their islands in this atoll. So, you know, this is something that we don't see, we don't hear about very much. Maybe if you live in Santa Barbara, California, you might see the arc of fire across the sky from time to time when they do these test launches. But, you know, this is an ongoing process, not just of testing their reliability, but of honing their accuracy and first strike capability. It's very concerning, and it's something I think that we need to address more, and I think it's something that, like I say, we need to seriously look at how did the civil rights movement really gain momentum. It was in large part through mass civil disobedience. How did the U.S. labor movement gain the momentum that it had? It was very large part through mass civil disobedience. Even iconic events like Standing Rock. My family and I went out to Standing Rock a couple of times when that encampment was happening. And unfortunately, the result was not as decisive in stopping the pipeline as people had hoped. But, you know, to even have a chance of that, they had to mobilize thousands and thousands of people, right? So I think that's a really important, sobering and important fact for people inside and outside the nuclear disarmament movement to consider, is how social movements actually achieve the critical mass and strength to force policy change. And I think historically, it doesn't happen without mass civil disobedience.
And the mass civil disobedience, I got to say, there's probably a half a dozen things that people can be upset about these days. I don't even have to name them because I'm sure our listeners can just think of them as soon as I mention that. And I wonder if people are just becoming jaded or if they're just having, I used to call it disaster fatigue, that there's so many things coming down the pike that are disaster or disaster related. We start to just say, well, I'm just going to watch Netflix and chill.
Right.
Instead of getting out there and doing something, because getting out there and doing something is hard to do, especially the older we get. I don't even know the answer to my own question. It's not really a question. It's just sort of a statement.
Yeah,
it's just an observation.
Well, there is enormous inertia and enormous apathy and enormous disillusionment that exists in this country and perhaps some other countries as well. But certainly here in the United States, we can see this enormous levels of distraction by media, entertainment, and I think too by the political feuds that go back and forth between the so-called right and the so-called left. But I think what people are starting to realize is that every cause, every issue, every thing that we work for or care about, be we progressives or conservatives, is at risk if the escalation between the U.S. and Russia or the U.S. and China continues to the point of a very, very possible global nuclear cataclysm. And so, you know, there was just a town hall meeting or something that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, did back east. And she was confronted by people in the audience, young people of color, actually, who challenged her support for this tens and tens of billions of dollars flowing into Ukraine with the lack of any substantive negotiations for a compromise there to prevent this continual escalation. So, I mean, I think people are, and these folks were specifically talking about how everything that we're working for, all of our causes are at risk if there is a global nuclear war, which is looking more and more plausible. So, I mean, I think some people are starting to wake up, but it is a very difficult challenge that we're facing.
Absolutely. Peter Lumsdaine, thanks so much for being with us on Attention Please. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Okay. Well, again, I just want to encourage people, you know, to contact that email if you would like to have a discussion in your church, in your community organization, your campus, students, anything, to talk about this in greater depth.
TierraLinda@live.com.
That is correct. Thank
you. All right. Thank you, Peter, so much. This is Attention Please at KPTZ 91.9 FM. This is Jim Burke, your host this week. Thanks a lot for joining us.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man.